Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight to hear Dr. Graham Starr talk for us. He makes a first appearance at the Sydney Institute tonight. Now, he studied at Sydney University. He did an MA at Carleton University in Canada, a PhD at West Virginia. He became a senior research officer at the New South Wales Liberal Party, working with and under John Carrick, and then he had held a similar position at the Federal Secretariat of the Liberal Party in Canberra. He's held a number of academic positions and is currently a visiting fellow at the Public Policy Institute at the Australian Catholic University on the Canberra campus. And his publications include a documentary history of the Liberal Party, a monograph, a short book on state aid and government assistance to non-government schools, and most recently this book, Carrick, Principles, Politics and Policy, on Sir John Carrick, which has just been published by Anthony Capello at Concord Publishing. And tonight, Dr. Starr is going to speak for us on the topic, John Carrick in Australian Politics. Graham, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Jared. And thanks to the Sydney Institute. I should also thank, for this book, the Public Policy Institute of the Australian Catholic University, which has supported the book. And I think with good reason in respect of Sir John Carrick. I just came down tonight on the train from the mountains where I now live, and on the way down I was thinking about something I once read about Oliver Wendell Holmes on a train trip. I was thinking of a way of starting a discussion on somebody that I've worked on and off with over so many years. Holmes was travelling on a train and a conductor came along and asked him for his ticket. Holmes went through all his pockets and couldn't find the ticket. The conductor said, "Well, don't worry about it, Judge. I know who you are. Why don't you just send the ticket along?" And Holmes said, "Look, the problem's not just that I can't find the ticket. It's trying to remember where I'm going." Why that is significant, it's a warning to you that I've recently become rather attached to history. Particularly in the sense of organisations, and most particularly in respect of the Liberal Party, which is a party that doesn't have a history, or at least it refuses to believe that it has a history. I believe that an organisation must have a history, because its history is really the ticket to where it's going. And if it's lost its history, it doesn't know where it's going, and it's just got to go where the tracks take it. Oliver Wendell Holmes's train. So, having said that, let's get into the little book, which I'd love to hold up. That's already been done for me. A couple of years ago, I was told that there had to be a biography of Sir John Carrick. Now, I was pretty easy to persuade that that was so. For more than a personal reason, but the personal reason was that this year, 2013, marks 50 years since I took my first job with John Carrick. I'd just graduated from Sydney University, and a little man turned up at the house I was living with my parents out in the western suburbs and said, "Are you Graham Starr?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "John Carrick wants a research officer. You've got to go and apply." And that was the first contact I had ever had with John's party, or with John for that matter, and took the job exactly almost 50 years ago to the day. So for personal reasons, I thought, well, I would like to get involved in that project. But more important than that, I think two much more important reasons. One, that he certainly does deserve a biography. His life is a very, very good story, an interesting story. I think right back from his very early days around Sydney to his wartime experience with Sparrow Force and then as a prisoner of war, come back from the war and within a couple of weeks found himself a job as research officer for a new political party, which was the Liberal Party. Within a couple of years, he was general secretary of that party and went on to become very, very soon, actually, very, very early in a relatively young life, pretty much the conscience of that party's philosophy. Became a close associate then with the three of our four longest-serving prime ministers, that is with Menzies, basically a key advisor to Menzies. Menzies told him, and I report this in the book, Menzies told him that, my job is to be distracted, he said, of the prime ministership. Your job, he said, is to think long term. And right from that very, very early stage, John Carrick had the role of thinking long term for his party, and it became very long term. He actually took the job as research officer and then as general secretary as a temporary job, as something easy to do while he was recovering from his wartime experience. He found that politics was a nice relaxing way to live, but not for long. But he went on in that job as general secretary for about 25 years and then, of course, went into the Senate, became leader of the government in the Senate, Minister for Education in particular, a couple of other portfolios as well. Then into retirement, which is the weirdest retirement I've ever seen. It was first of all heading up the Carrick Committee into Education in New South Wales, and then and now, probably at this very moment, he's turning his eye to problems like early childhood education and so on, which is now a preoccupation for him. So all that, I think, does deserve a biography. The other reason is something that I alluded to a moment ago, and that was the fact that he spent most of his time in a political organisation that actually runs from its history. It doesn't want to know about its history, and it doesn't, for some reason, want anybody else to know either. And it's a shame, because it's a very, very good history. It is probably, and I can say this reasonably freely, because only on and off have I ever been a member, and all the time I worked for the Liberal Party, which was on and off, for various reasons, I wasn't a member of the party, but it has been a very, very successful political organisation. For that reason, its success might have made it shy of publicity. Some years ago, right after the Menzies era, when it first went into opposition, the party revised its platform. It hadn't done that for quite some time. When they came out with a new platform, I was an advisor to the Federal Secretariat, and I suggested that they should have a fellow like Sir Robert Menzies on the cover of the platform. But the two leaders of the party, or the leader and the deputy leader at the time, said, "No, we can't have Menzies. That'll make it look as if we're looking backwards. What we need on the front of the platform is a sunburst," which they got, and then burst. They didn't do too well for quite a little while. Again, a couple of years ago, when I was state director of the party, we had in the stairs, we had a large photograph of Sir Robert Menzies. And one day, a very senior, youngish member of the party came to see me and said, "Who's that old man in the picture on the stairs?" he hadn't been gone for 10 or so years at that stage. Now, by contrast, the Labour Party writes books about its party. They erect statues. They name city squares all over the place for their leaders, both successful and unsuccessful. We treat our former leaders like mad uncles, don't we? We tend to hide them away and don't want them seen. So again, I feel that anything that can be written about somebody like John Carrick, anything that can be written should be written. Now the problem there is, I thought it was a great idea to write a book, but I didn't think it should be me. I was easily persuaded that there should be a book. I was not persuaded that I should write the book, mainly because I knew he didn't want one. He absolutely rejected the idea. I had to almost go so far as to promise not to mention his name in the biography. Not quite, but I almost had to go that far. So what I did, I said, look, I don't actually want to write about you. I want to write about the principles that have that you're pursued in getting this political life together and building such a successful organisation. And so we got along. All the time I was doing it, he was more interested in the idea that I really should write a history of the Ottoman Empire. And every time we got into a nice little piece of research about his life and about politics in his era, I think it's safe to call it his era. He had such an influence on party organisation at the time. All the time he was, well, when are you going to get onto the Ottoman Empire? And or other things, other suggestions, anything like the role of the family, the role of the family in education, because that is a continuing hobby horse, and so on. But no, we did the Liberal Party. Now, the last 70 years, I think, are probably an era where a significant part of it could be called the Carrick era. And it's been an era of great stability. I think I'd chance the wrath of other political science colleagues in saying that one of the reasons for the stability over this period might just be John Carrick. But look, there are important questions to ask about that era in politics, and that's sort of what we're talking about. And they're both ones that are really quite relevant to the sorts of contributions that he made to politics. And I try to hint at these through the book. The first is, the parties, while it has been an era of change and of stability, I should say, in terms of the party system, the parties over recent years, recent decades, I guess, probably since John left, have been going through tremendous change, really dramatic change. And a question I'd ask in respect of that is, have they changed so much that they no longer are able to perform the vital functions that we expect of parties? We've all read the textbooks about political parties, and we know what these basic functions are, and they come up with words like interest aggregation and interest articulation and all these textbooky sorts of things. And the one that I'm particularly keen on, which we might come to in a moment, is they have a very, very important function of keeping elections fair and honest. A lot of people who haven't thought terribly much about that say, no, that's not a function of parties. But I say, not is it just a function of parties, it's the most important function of parties, that our elections wouldn't be so fair, wouldn't be so honest, without parties keeping an eye on each other and doing the things that parties used to do extremely well, particularly in the Carrick era. So my undertaking was to look at the subheading of the book. Having promised not to use his name, I was a little bit ashamed to go along and tell him that we're going to call the book Carrick, but I had to live with that. But we went with the subtitle, Principles, Politics and Policy. Now, there's a theory of history that the historians among you might be familiar with. It's called the 1895 Ohio Theory of History. Back in 1895, there were two motor cars in the state of Ohio. And one day, their two owners decided to take them out for a spin, and the inevitable thing happened. They ran into each other. The very two cars in one state. And that became known as the 1895 Ohio Theory of History. The theory is that if there are two entities existing at the same time and in the same place, sooner or later they're going to clash. And I think that explains Australian party history, at least in the parties of the past 70 years, but probably throughout our history. There have been two similar entities. They like to throw things at each other and call each other names and so on, but they're similar in structure and in their roles, but they clash on certain vital things. And it's the vital things that they clash in that makes the Ohio 1895 theory relevant. There are two fundamentally different outlooks for these organisations, both quite, and I'm being very, very careful here, both quite respectable, both equally valid, but quite contradictory of each other. Now, my observation of, say, one side of politics over this long period, and as I say, for 50 years I've been looking at it, so I'm old enough to be able to think in terms of then and now, even if change makes then and now a pretty tall order. But the fundamental difference, I think, is that one side is optimistic about individuals and pessimistic about institutions and governments and state. The other side is pessimistic about what individuals can do for themselves, but optimistic about what the state can do. And that, throughout a long period that I was looking at, does sort of sum the two sides up. So certainly to my satisfaction, there are other riders to that. One side looks to federalism as an ideal way of reconciling the advantages of unity with the benefits of diversity. The other side looks more to a centralized state. One side looks to promoting the idea that people can fix things for themselves. If their lives are fixed, it likes to give the opportunity for them to fix it. The other side says, and I saw this in words as precise as this, just on the weekend on television, when the Prime Minister said, "We will fix it for you." And now they're the two contrasting sides. They're two outlooks. They're both quite legitimate outlooks, but they were bound to clash from time to time, and hence our history. Now, those principles on the one side, on the side that Carrick represents, took some time to articulate. When his party was formed back in 1944... The founders of that party said, look, the first thing we've got to do, we've got to rebuild in a vacuum, because our predecessor parties weren't able to articulate what we were all about. Menzies said, look, the problem is we don't have anything like a statement of what our goals are. And they had to set about doing that, and they came up with a platform, and they came up with some ideas about a platform that help set the pattern for the stability of politics in the subsequent years. They also took the view that an organisation, a party organisation, was really the trustee of the philosophy of the party. And therefore, they had to make a distinction that previous parties hadn't made between the role of the organisation and the people in the organisation and the role of the people that they sent to Parliament. And they made a distinction between platform and policy. The platform with a fundamental statement of beliefs and principles and philosophies and so on which the people in the organisation expected the parliamentarians to base their policy. And it worked pretty well. Occasionally there were little fights between those two groups, of course, and that's only to be expected, and certainly was expected. But they were able to articulate the principles, and one of the best expressions of those principles was a little document that was cooked up by Carrick and his founding president in New South Wales, who was Sir William Spooner, who some of you will remember, who deserves to be remembered by everybody. He was one of the eminent people in Australian politics. He also stressed that more attention had to be given to not just the philosophical principles that had to be settled, but the organisational principles. And again, that role fell largely to a little group of people around John Carrick, people like Bob Cotton, remember Senator Bob Cotton, and Spooner, of course, and Menzies and Carrick, and a fellow named John McConnell, who was Carrick's opposite number in the Victorian Liberal Party. But Carrick's contribution to this was a little document that went around the country, and it was simply called The Liberal Way of Progress. It was one of the, I think, more important documents in Australian political party history, and it deserves to be pulled out from time to time. If you have one tucked in that little box in the bottom of your cupboard somewhere, it deserves to be read. But the two organising principles, Menzies stressed too, that there weren't just these philosophical principles, but also organisational principles. The first, he said, was a funding code. We must have a code for the funding of the party, because if we don't get that right, the party will go with the Uniting Australian Party, which collapsed basically because it lost control over its own funds. And the other one was a pre-selection system. a pre-selection system that would be sacrosanct, that couldn't be manipulated, couldn't become just a victim of factional fights and so on. And these were two principles that were developed by this little group of people around Carrick in the 50s that established quite a bit about the character of politics in the era. Well, these two principles that were developed, I think they became known pretty widely as the Carrick principles. Some people started to scoff at them because they say the party code wasn't real. And some people say, no, the pre-selections were manipulated by a little group of people called Carrick's Mafia or something like that. But it was never quite so. The people who said that tended to be the people who lost. And, you know, they're always looking for something, somebody to blame. The Carrick principles are still followed by all the wise leaders of the party. They're still adhered to. Well, moving on quickly, from principles to the second of our P's, politics. The role of the General Secretary in this era became basically to protect those principles and to protect the party leaders from playing a little fast and loose with some of those principles, as they're inclined to do from time to time, because they have a preoccupation of their own that they have to consider. So to get somebody to do that, of course, they needed somebody with rather good survival skills. Well, somebody who makes it for 3.5 years as a prisoner of the Japanese has probably learned a little bit about survival, and so he was the right man for the job. In fact, he speaks, and I quote him in the book, speaks of that experience as a prisoner of war as an enduring learning experience, which isn't half bad, I think. As I said, he took a temporary job, and basically as a political architect. His role was a political architect, and that's what his side of politics needed at the time. They had to work in a vacuum to put together something that was going to change the nature of politics in New South Wales, and they were told all the time they were doing this that up until 1949 they were told that they were really flogging a dead horse, because you will never win with Menzies, which was the cry at the time. They did, of course. But they also knew from the outset that they had to get the politics right, and they had to work on some very, very, very major problems. The ones that they set out and that have influenced the subsequent trends in politics, I think, relate first to finance, to party finance, second to the concept of membership in a political organisation, three to the structure of the branches, getting branches around the community, then to question of staffing, then to the problem, the very, very serious problem of factionalism, and finally to the idea of, to the nature of the campaign organisation. Now, the staff thing, the finance thing was settled pretty well, because they knew that the old United Australian Party had collapsed because it had lost control, and they developed a code, and we've already talked about that. That lasted pretty well until we in Australia made a very serious mistake and introduced public funding of political parties, because that more or less destroyed the code. One of the elements of the code was that donations were going to be voluntary and were going to be confidential, and the policy makers were going to be isolated from knowledge of where the money was coming from. Once public funding was introduced, they also had compulsory disclosure of any significant contribution to political party, and you can't isolate the policy makers from the sources of party funds if it's all disclosed to the public. Personally, I'm a cynic on the whole question of public funding, and I think that was the purpose of introducing the code, because everybody knew where Labor's funds came from anyway, but the Libs followed the code pretty well. Every now and then some party leader did play a little fast and loose with the funds, but there were grounds for wrapping them across the knuckles a little bit and say, get with the act. The second of these organisational problems was question of membership. The old United Australia Party had something like 30 or 40,000 members across Australia, which was nothing really, and no real role for them. No, the Liberal Party in Carrick's days as General Secretary went from nothing to 1950, when they had 178,000 members across Australia, 44 in New South Wales, and membership became an important function. The branches, again, they went from nothing. They used to be basically little organisations that rarely met except to get into factional mischief back in the early days. By the time, by the time 1950 came around, there were something like 440 branches across Australia and 200 and some in New South Wales, and all pretty active. And they had a very important role, and one I think where we're lacking now, because each of these branches, there were branches I've found that numbered as many as 900 members. And they were all the decent-sized ones, were basically microcosms of their community, so that they were represented in the branch meetings. And I belonged to one when I first joined John's staff, a branch at Lidcombe that had 9 members. But they met every month, and every time they did, they had a member of parliament or somebody come along to tell them how important they were. It was pretty good for people, particularly in the hard luck areas. But in the good branches, they were microcosms of their community, and they performed a very important communications function, in that because they had just about every organisation within the community was represented in that branch, it was the ideal place for a Menzies to be able to pick up the phone to the General Secretary and say, John, I want to know what the people out there are thinking about policy X. And John could say, I'll check with my field officers and find where you've got where we've got a meeting, and we'll get something back to you in the morning. And they were able to get it out and put it to people. That job's been taken over pretty much by polls and pollsters and so on, but I don't think it's as done as effectively as it was with that sort of organisation, that conduit function. Also, it was a good way of getting the message from the community back to the politicians. Not just getting a message out, but getting a message back. That conduit function of the branches was important. Look, I don't know how branches work these days. I don't know that they do in many cases. I think very often they're just a few telephone calls taken from somebody's bathroom or something like that. You know, there's not that same sort of reverence given to the branches. Pollsters and television have probably taken over those roles pretty well. If you want to communicate now, you just get on television and announce something and call a press conference, and it's out there. If you want to get the view of the people, you just conduct a poll. Well, I could talk forever about polls because I've had some funny experiences with them. I've become very untrusting of polls. Well, the branches were important. The staff was more important. At the best of times during this era, our politics, most of the political work was done by a team of about 40 field officers, they were called. They were incredible people. Mostly they were people who'd come back from the war and had a bit of a pension, and they took a professional job and became extremely professional. In fact, the little fellow who called on me at my parents' house in Granville back in 1961, when he knocked on the door, I said, "Who are you?" And he said what his name was. I won't tell you because he's now quite famous. I said, why'd you come here? What made you think I might be a Liberal or interested in the Liberal Party? He said, "I'm a Liberal Party field officer. I know everything." And he did. and he did. He reported back to Carrick, as did all his colleagues, and they were really, really quite amazing. Factionalism, of course. Well, we all know about factionalism. I think it's been destructive of both political parties, and I'm not quite sure what they can do about it. But if we had to answer that question, are they now capable of carrying out their important functions? The answer quickly becomes no when you start looking at some of the factional activities of organisations. I think we're seeing it at the moment, but not necessarily on John's side of politics, although you don't have to dig very deeply to find that sort of problems there. The other function, of course, was campaigning, and that, when we're talking about politics, is probably what comes more immediately to mind. We don't have political campaigns anymore. We have advertising campaigns. I remember John telling me while I was putting this book together that when he was in the middle of a political campaign, he'd call in the advertising agency, say, "Look, this is what we want. Draw a little picture and say that's what we want." And he said basically the the advertisements in the newspapers and on television should show a picture of the leader and should tell what the policy is, and no more than that. There's no way, for example, I think today, what we got $50 million just to advertise one government policy. Well, there's no way a political party can really compete with that. The idea is to get a quick message about the leader. In America, they call this theory the Hymie's ferry boat theory, about a Tammany Hall boss named Hymie Shorenstein, and the candidate come along and complained that every time he did an ad, all he did was put Franklin Roosevelt's face there, and this guy said, "Everybody knows Roosevelt, nobody knows me, you should put my face on the ad." And Hymie said, "Have you ever been down there to Staten Island and see the ferry come in? When it comes in, it just doesn't come in alone, it drags in all the crap from the harbour." And he said, "Well, Franklin Roosevelt's our ferry boat." This was the approach to advertising that was taken. Carrick says, and I think if you saw him now, he'd say, "Yeah, my ads were the worst ads ever in politics. They just won elections," which is an interesting thing, I feel. Although the agencies always say, and I found this with my few little run-ins with politics, after an election that you've lost, almost invariably the agency will tell you, "Look, we won the campaign, but you guys lost the election," you know. That was something that he tended to dismiss. Look, his idea of a successful campaign was a campaign where the whole organisation was involved. His two basic messages: one was that you've got to get out and harvest the votes. You've got to get out and check the rolls. You've got to be there at all the little corner, you know, postings, looking out for the absent votes and all those sorts of things. And do all that hard work on the street. That was harvesting the vote. And the central message that he put out, and I hesitate to say it because I know a few of you knew him well and you've heard the expression time and time again, but his basic message for political campaigning is, you can't fatten the pig on market day. I was explaining this message to my son in the train, my grandson, I should say, in the train coming down, because he's currently working on the HSC and he's sitting up the back studying like mad this very moment. And I asked him what that meant, and he said, "I think it means that when you've got an exam on Wednesday, you shouldn't really start studying on Tuesday." And that was the essence of John Carrick's message on campaigning. John Howard, who's very kindly written a nice little preface to the book, has written what he saw, and he regards Carrick as his mentor, just as Menzies regarded him as the person who should be looking to the future. But Howard basically sums up what Carrick's attitude to campaigning was. He said, "There is no particular magic in huge expenditure. You don't need all the bells and whistles, all the slogans and focus groups. All you really need is to explain the big issues to the people in words they understand. Even the very complex issues like those of 1975, and you let the people decide. They usually," he said, "get it right." Now, Howard says that he learned everything that he knows that's of any value in politics from John Carrick, and I think that's one of the things that he actually did learn. Well, the third P, if I have time to talk about the third P.
3 minutes.
Oh, I can do that. I can do that really easy. The third P was policy. We looked at principles, and politics should be based on principles, and the policy should be based on the principles and the politics. Good politics, he insists, good politics is based on action, not just rhetoric. It's based on principle, tempered by political reality, of course. It shouldn't descend into simple ideology. It should always be based on research. By that, we don't mean polls and focus groups and all that, but real research, getting to the facts. Is this going to work? Pragmatic research. Is it going to work? Is there something better that might be tried? Is there something that might be more effective? Practical, pragmatic questions like that are what politics was all about. Throughout that period, throughout what we've started to call the Carrick era here. I don't know if I've ever used the phrase before, but it'll do for our discussion. Throughout that, I found doing research and policy in that area, there were three elements that kept coming out on which people in policy-making positions, the senior people in the party, continually stressed. First of these was the need to have policies that will help to overcome our international vulnerability, to make the country secure following the long period of depression and war that had preceded the founding of the organisation. That is one task. The second was expanding our national self-sufficiency through policies that might encourage exploration and innovation, development, national development, and so on, meeting our national needs to generate a degree of self-sufficiency. The third of these elements was maximising the scope of choice and opportunity. Now, I'm not prepared to judge whether or not, the Menzies era met those sorts of goals in policy, but if you look through the sorts of documents that were floating around at the time on development of policy, these were the three elements that were pursued. You might judge for yourself whether or not they were actually captured, but they were pursued. The third of these, that is the idea of maximising the scope for choice and opportunity, basically what was meant there was we should establish principles of egalitarianism in practice, not just rhetoric. Talking about equality and egalitarianism and so on doesn't really mean much unless you're actually achieving it in practice. And that means looking at policies for health and housing and general areas like that. But the preeminent one, of course, was education, which, as we said, became John's preoccupation. I'd like to say a little bit about his approach to education. It takes us back to very, very briefly. Let me just, I'll tell you what I'll do. Just to point out that his consideration of education fell back on those principles that we talked about on the outlook. Let me give you a quote from the book, page 241, for those of you who have the prayer book. He said, in his first day as Minister for Education, he said, "They put on my desk a pile of letters for me to sign on disadvantaged schools. I asked them what it was about, and they said that there was a policy of disadvantaged schools brought in by the Whitlam government, and we send out money to individual schools." He says, "So I picked up the first one, and it said Bunbury School in Western Australia was a disadvantaged school. I said, 'I'm sorry, but I've never been to Bunbury. Have you asked the state governments there whether it feels that Bunbury School is more disadvantaged than others?' 'No, we haven't,' they replied. So I sent them all back to the state ministers and said that we had these requests, and what did they think of them? The idea of a minister sitting in Canberra could know what was going on in a Redfern school or somewhere else like Bunbury is absolute nonsense." So his attitude to education through that period and subsequently, I think, and before that, remember we're talking about a person whose initiation in public policy was in education and with Menzies in developing a good approach to solving what was becoming a massive problem for a lot of smaller independent schools. And together they put up the sorts of policies that gave us the aid system that we have for independent schools now. Through that and through education, Minister for Education and subsequently, the same sorts of principles prevailed and still do. As I said, he's sitting at home now thinking about what more can be educated. I think he achieved an enormous amount in education, and that has been recognised through a number of the best honours that the country can bestow upon him. Most important thing, and I'll finish with this, is that what he achieved was to give certainty to parents, because I quote him as saying that education commences at its most important phase, which is at the parent's knee, certainly to parents and to schools, but without all the wild rhetoric of revolutions. We didn't have revolutions in education in those days. We just tried to get things done, tried to establish these principles without risking the value of choice, but more important, without risking the consequence of letting the feds into the classroom. And I think, seeing as with a federal minister who was doing that, that makes it pretty notable. Well, thank you.
Thanks, Graham. So we come to questions and discussion. We've got till no later than 7 p.m. Janet Grundy's got some copies of Graham's book, Carrick Principles, Politics and Policy, and I'm sure that the author would be happy to sign any copies here tonight. So we kick off. It's an important presentation about a significant figure. Obviously, John Carrick was a great political operative and a good minister in the Fraser government. I suspect, however, he wasn't very good at selling himself or policies. I don't recall in the Fraser government that he was a dramatic seller of the policies of the Fraser government. When I wrote my book, Menzies Child, I did an important interview with him up at his home. I came back to the office, got a transcript typed up, and a letter arrived the next day saying it was all off the record, I couldn't use any of it. I never understood why, except I think John Carrick didn't want to sell what he was on about, but it was a good message. And I just wonder if you haven't inherited a bit of that, because today you tell us that you're invited to work for John Carrick when you got a knock on the door by a man, a small man, who became quite famous. This is over 50 years ago, and he's just given you a job, which is a pretty good job, which you did well. Why don't you tell us his name? What, that can't be a secret. And if it is, it's beyond the 30-year rule. It's nearly 60 years. Here we are.
I'll reveal, yes. Well, you're quite right. And only a few of you will recognise this famous name from the past. His name was Bill Wakeling. He was a field officer starting back with the old National Party back during World War I. He first became involved as a political organiser. He told me some years later that he was his first claim to fame, that he put National Party how to vote posters on the ceilings of a lot of houses up around the Cross. Everybody who was a prominent member of his organisation during that period knew Bill Wakeling. I think one of the most dramatic things he did back in the election of 1961, remember, the Menzies government nearly lost and there was a seat in Queensland, and the survival of the Menzies government depended upon holding that seat. I think it was Jim Killen's first election, and they had to get somebody up there who knew a little bit about scrutineering. Well, it was Bill Wakeling who probably went up and... he did go up and probably saved the day. So I'm sorry it's not a name that's known to all of you, but anybody who in that period had any sort of experience with that party will remember him. He was covered in cigarette ash and just wouldn't like people mentioning his name around for some reason. So, thank you.
Now, when I asked you to be frank in relation to the King's Cross story, I didn't ask you to be that frank. Right, so right down the back. Don't stand in front of the camera, by the way. Yes, Matt. Graham, will you just stand and stay here?
Matt, thanks once, Graham, for your presentation and writing a book. Based on what you said about the Liberal Party doesn't write about itself very well, and Jared's comments about John Carrick being a very modest man, how hard was it to research for the book? And what type of sources did you use to basically come up with?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting one. He was my primary source, actually, because once I persuaded him that there had to be a biography, it was pretty easy to persuade him that it better be the most authoritative one possible. So we spent a lot of time together, which is a very pleasant experience for me. He's now... he's been around for a long while. He was born in 1917. But he's still got very good records that I'd rather like to inherit one day. Has a very, very lengthy interview with the Parliamentary Library that's available on record there. And then it was a matter of, all his papers, he kept very, very good records as General Secretary for the entire time he was General Secretary, and they're all deposited in the library just up the road. And you can get access to those, and they're tremendous. I just wish I'd kept such good records when I had my little time in that role. So they're around, and then just interviewing as many colleagues as I could. Plus the fact that, as I said, I've been around a pretty fair while myself, so a lot of this I simply knew from experience over the years.
Question right down the back.
Graham, Tim James, thanks for your presentation. I like the title of the book, Principles, Politics, and Policy. They should be what we're on about in modern-day politics, but these days all too often it is about power, polls, personalities and so on. How do we get back to what really matters and the depth and the meaning of the substance of principles, politics and policy?
Look, I'll be caned out of the building and out of a lot of buildings around the place if I gave you the honest answer. I'll do it. Look, I think the parties deserve to be a little poorer than they are. I think public funding ruined the parties. Suddenly they went from being people who had to rely on or organisations that had to rely on people to organisations that became too reliant upon money. They became rich beyond their dreams of avarice, really, once public funding hit the deck. They didn't have to go back to the people. I think public funding basically subsidises advertising agencies and newspapers and television stations rather than the parties. The idea of those funds being used for more practical purposes, like building up the organisations, would help. But you've got to get people making a few sacrifices, getting out and wearing out their shoe leather, learning some of those basic skills like how to cleanse the electoral roll. And that's still an important role. I think it's been done a little bit more by officials and so on now. But some years ago, one of the parties went out to the electorate of Phillip in Sydney. Just little incidents like finding something like 35 people enrolled at one little address of one in a one-bedroom house. It's worth getting out and doing a lot of that basic work rather than enrolling on just the information that comes through electronic means. Now, the parties are doing some interesting things with the new media and with computer work and so on. You know, a lot of that's excellent stuff. And it might even take us back. But I think probably I was rather relieved. I started writing a couple of major articles this week when they talked about increasing the money, because I don't think they need more money. They'd love more, and so would I. But I'm retired, you know. Everybody would like a little more. But the parties need desperately to be poor again for a little while. When they were at their poorest, they were at their best.
So Michael Bohm.
Carrick's remarkable success in federal politics, apart from some obvious blunders, I mean, he recommended that I should stand for MacArthur, for example. But his remarkable success seems to me in curious conflict, if you like, with the fact that the Liberals were out of government in New South Wales for the great bulk of his time as General Secretary. Why was he so relatively unsuccessful in New South Wales and so successful federally?
You know, there are a couple of theories. His theory it was that while he didn't quite pick up the seats, he won on the votes, and he came very very close, and in fact did get a good plurality a couple of times. Votes in seats in New South Wales have always been rigged. Who has ever had the numbers has been the person who's conducted the reforms. And whenever you hear somebody talking about reforms of electoral systems, you should go and count the silverware. Really, that's in the nature of politics. There was also another theory around that he took the view that it was better to win federal government than to win state government. That was the big prize. Now, I don't think either of those really answers the question, but I can't do any better.
So right down the back, John. We're going to be quick now. Yeah, John. Yep.
Graham, you mentioned how robust the Liberal Party was in the Howard era, only in the Carrick era, and the fact that all the leaders of the local community could be members of the party. And of course, what we've got now is really the shell of that. And that is all dissipating, not only for the Liberal Party, but also for the Labour Party. Mm. Would you like to comment on the possible threat to the democracy, and the fact that parties are no longer representative of the community? They say they represent.
Yeah, look, I think you've hit right on it. There's nothing much more I can add to that. I think it is a threat that the parties aren't the dynamic forces that they were in the community. Now, personally, I was never in favour of the political parties getting involved in local government. I think that has helped destroy them a bit. Every now and then I get invited to go along and talk to a party branch or conference. And I think, well, look, there are matters of world-shattering importance that could be debated here, and I sit down and listen to an hour's debate on curbing and guttering or something like that, you know. That's not the sort of thing that encourages a lot of people in. You can make a very good case for them being in local government, but it doesn't convince me. I think they've got to get down to having those meetings. Politicians, I had a way of doing this once. Nobody bought it, but it was a great idea. And that was that every sitting member ought to have on his application for re-endorsement a list of all the branches in hard luck seats that he's gone out to address during the past 3 years. Now, it's pretty hard to find a Member of Parliament who thinks that that's a good idea. But there has to be ways to get the people to believe that they're important again. And I think a group of people in all the parties, both the parties, should get together and say, you know, how can we revive our influence in the community?
Okay, Catherine.
Yes. Putting aside his amazing political legacy, how would you personally describe John Carrick as a man?
Oh, goodness, you'll have to buy the book. I'll give you 390-odd pages.
Yeah, but it's a good question.
That's a very good question.
Yeah. Look, how would you describe him as a man?
As a man, he is a man of principle, and principle first. He believes, as a man, that if you are straight with what you say, and if you base your decisions on principle, you're going to get the best results. I don't know that I can say terribly much more than that. I think it says it all. And I think those principles are principles that have been acquired. That's why I spent a lot of time in the early part of the book looking at childhood in Australia in that period after the First World War and before the Depression, and the influence that that has on establishing those sorts of principles. And then the sorts of principles that were reinforced by sitting on Timor with 1,000 other men and having the Japanese drop 20,000 paratroops and marines on top of you, and what that did, and then the subsequent period in the war. These are the sorts of things that reinforce principles that make life either successful or unsuccessful. So I can't go further than saying a man primarily of principle.
How did he treat a Menzies compared with the way he treated a janitor?
I thought sometimes when I worked for him the first time, I was just out of university and I was a wee boy, and I could have easily been the janitor around the office in those days, because we all had to pitch in and do things. When I was doing those sorts of things, he was doing them too. He ran around with a dusting brush from time to time. Menzies regarded him as his student. He didn't necessarily regard John Howard as his student, although he didn't go so far as to give Howard, he said he saw him as a person with considerable potential, but he didn't give him a rails run, he said, into Parliament. The janitor, if he was going to do something with his life, was going to have to do it himself. Basically, I don't know that I'd ever saw him treat any two different people differently. Pretty much the same.
Okay, so there's a question here, then we go one down. Yep.
Just to add to what you've said, in the 1960s, I was a young account executive with Goldberg Advertising, working on particularly the 61 and 63 campaigns. And I used to carry those scribbles of John Carrick's back to the agency, one of which said 36 faceless men. I believe that won the election.
I did.
For that. However, I found John Carrick to be... I don't think I've ever met a person of greater wit and intelligence and a diplomat.
That'd be brief.
Just recently, when he was given the Order of Australia, I wrote to him, congratulated him, and thanked him for what he taught me in personal relations. He wrote back a really gracious letter, and all I can say, no greater comment, that he's a gentleman.
Okay,
good.
All right. Okay, question down there? Yeah.
Did Carrick have a view about free university education, and what did he do in relation to that?
Did he have a view about free university education?
I think he... Look, I can't speak for him. My recollection is that his own education was at university, not paid for by him, but paid for by the company he worked for as a part-time student. I can't go into detail. He certainly believed that as many people who could should find their way to university, but I can't think of anything that he actually said or did specifically on education. Somebody else might be more familiar with
it. Well, the free education that Whitlam introduced, tertiary education, was continued by the Fraser government and abandoned by the Hawke government.
Yeah,
so he let
true.
It go.
Yes.
Yeah. Right, so who's next? Right down, don't stand in front of the camera. Yep.
Could you tell us where you put Sir John on the spectrum within the Liberal Party between dries and wets or conservatives?
And
what influence did it have on how?
Jared actually answered a question on pretty much along these lines in your column a week or so ago when somebody else suggested that somebody fell into the Howard camp and somebody else fell into the Menzies camp. Carrick was very much a Howard man and very much a Menzies man, and he would regard the debate that goes on in some parts of the party along those lines as pretty irrelevant. You'd find it very, very difficult, I think, to tab him on one side or the other. He wouldn't care for it very much, actually, at all. So, I don't think he fits logically, but then again, I don't think many people in the party fit very logically into one side or the other. As some of you know, I've had a little dealing with factions from time to time, and these things are supposed to be wrapped around factions. I don't find much consistency along ideological lines in any of the little factions and groups in the party. They're more about somebody's play for power than anything else.
Can I just conclude? I guess the most traumatic part of his life was obviously his time in the prison of war camp. I think he became quite friendly with Tommy Wren, who, among others, the Labour man who was one of the many Australians who were caught up. But what does he say to you about that time? I mean, in your speech you mentioned that, you know, he was persistent and resilient and whatever else, but what did he come away thinking of his captors?
Mm-hmm.
For example, what did he think of the Japanese? Did he bear grudges? Did he put up with it?
Well, very simply, and I do spend a bit of time on that because he talked about it. I never heard him talk terribly much about it years ago when I first met him, but lately he's been giving some thought to that. And he says, as he said then, he refused to acknowledge that he knew directly of any atrocities by his captors. He said he saw no point in carrying any sort of a grudge. It was all over and it had to be over, and he advised his colleagues and the men that served under him. He was a young lieutenant, he advised them to put the war behind them, and he's done that very well. Quite soon he visited Japan in various official capacities and so on, and he basically said it had to be regarded as a learning experience or you poisoned the rest of your life. And he said that quite specifically.
And what do you think of your book?
Well, he's a gentleman. He did say that he got a little bit of a shock when he was reading about the part where Harold Holt visited him one weekend, and it was a wee bit depressed. And John says, and he didn't actually tell me this, I found it in the interview, John said to him, "Look, Harold, why don't you go home and go for a swim?" And he'd forgotten about that until the book appeared.
Many thanks. So many thanks to Graham Starr for an important discussion about a significant figure not only in the Liberal Party of Australia but also in Australian political history, John Carrick, who's Sir John Carrick now, who's still alive and with us at an advanced age. And still obviously got a bit of humour left in him, which is nice, as Graham Starr's related. As I said, there's some copies of the book, Carrick, outside, but for now, just to our author who's here today, well done, and I hope the book goes well. Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.